But just to start out, I want to give a shout out to NREM, which is the National Resource for Automated Molecular Microscopy. That's where all the money comes for, you know, for us to do these kinds of technology developments and to have people visit and do collaborative work. So it's always important to acknowledge that there are not that many places that pay for technology development, and this is one of the few sources of that. So as a result of NREM, we've been developing a so-called streamlined pipeline. Some of you will be familiar with Legendon. That was the first thing we did, I don't know, 15 years ago. Said, let's automate the microscope. Let's take pictures automatically. And, you know, you can sit there and take 1,000 images or so a day, or 3,000 if you queue it up right. Now there's many, many other softwares to do that kind of thing. You know, there's EPU, a commercial version. And there's Serial EM and UCSF image and lots of software, and I think that's kind of a solved problem. And then we've also developed a processing pipeline, as have many others. But in the last 5 years or so, we've really tried to focus on the grid preparation because we agree with everybody else that that is really quite a bottleneck. And one of the things I want to say about efficiency, it's terribly important for us to be efficient. You'll see when you go and visit us, as I hope you will during the manufacturer's exhibit, at the SIMS Electron Microscopy Center, we have 7 microscopes, and 3 of them are Krioses. And, you know, this is what the number of users is extreme. We have 150 Krios users and 10 of them, new ones arriving every month. We're just gated by our training program. And that's what our data collection looks like right now. You know, it's a bit terrifying. This was Krios 1, there's Krios 2, and there's Krios 3. And that rise is fairly extreme. You know, that's 3.5 million images that have been acquired on these instruments. So it's terribly important to us to be efficient. We have a lot of users. Many of them are desperate to get onto the machines. So streamlining and efficiency is what we've been focusing on. And we think that the specimen prep has a large role to play in that. So for a really great specimen like Yifan, thank you, Yifan, again, for your beautiful 20S proteasome, you can stick that in the microscope, you know, collect, say, 500 images in half a day, perhaps. And because of our pipelines, we can automatically do the data processing. All this motion correction happens on the fly. We we estimate the CTF and correct for that on the fly. We pick particles on the fly. So all of that happens at the same rate as we can acquire data thanks to these graphics processing engines. And now with some of the very latest fast GPU systems, we can really get the data reconstructed on the fly too, so within the same day. I think it's increasingly important that we get an idea of what is happening with our sample while it's in the microscope. People are convinced they need 2 days, 4 days, 5 days, but sometimes the sample is garbage. So you need to be really looking at it after the first 6 hours or so you can decide whether it's a go, no-go on these extremely precious resources. Okay, so that's for a very good sample, but as we've been talking about the entire time, most samples we see, or many samples we see, are not great. Even simple things like, you know, the integrity of the carbon. These are two not atypical samples that I pulled out of our database that went into the Krios. You know, this is not something that somebody's screening. So people arrive thinking their grids are perfect, often smashed up, and you can see this is also very hydrophilic. And as has been now much mentioned, this again is not atypical of two images I randomly grabbed out of the database. You know, it's not hard to tell if there's sample there at all. Perhaps here there are scripts and scraps of it, but it's still it still wastes a lot of time at the microscope that we don't have great samples. So I'll be like Bob and hypothesize a little bit. This is definitely an hypothesis of what might be happening during vitrification. Here's just a movie I grabbed off the web. These yellow things are your proteins moving under Brownian motion of the water molecules bumping into them. And so when you put a thin film and get ready to vitrify, in that 1 second, as Bob pointed out and Chris pointed out, you have hundreds to thousands of opportunities for the protein to collide with those air-water interfaces and stick there. So then when we wick the sample down to a thin film, what we're left with is proteins stuck to the air-water interface. And you're going to see a lot more of this from Alex later on this afternoon. And sometimes the result is you get a big aggregated, ugly mess sticking to the air-water interface. And the other possibility that I think happens, and again, it's just a hypothesis, is we often don't see sample particles over the holes, but you see plenty over the carbon. So they may have a very high affinity for carbon. So basically, you're extracting the protein out of solution, and they're all ending up stuck to the carbon. So one way around that, so when you wick to a thin film, you've got almost no particles in the hole. One way around that is put a thin layer down, and then you can stick the protein to that layer. And here's an example of that being done by Vignesh in Ava Nogales' lab. And this works okay, but it's not great. You know, the images are a little bit ugly. It's kind of hard to see the particles on these kinds of images, and they got stuck in resolution as a result. They got around this later on by using a phase plate, actually. With the aid of the phase plate, the carbon layer became not such a tremendous problem, and they were able to get around it. Okay, so just so everybody knows this, so I'll just whip right through it. What do we do when we vitrify? We take our bulk sample and we turn it into a thin layer, and we do that often by smashing two large pieces of blotting paper against one or both sides of the grids. And the end result, one of the reason we started this project is I couldn't get over the tragedy of throwing away most of our sample. We save a few picoliters of it and we throw the rest in the trash can. And when people are struggling to make these integral membrane proteins, or they're having to purify something out of a cell because they can't express it, that's a real shame. So that's really what got us started. And the other problem is that, the grid doesn't look that great. Some of it's too thick, as Bob was mentioning. Some of it's too thin. It's kind of a mess. So the reason we got started on this was not really to solve these air-water interface problems. It was just to make it more efficient and stop wasting so much protein. So, the typical grids we get are like this from the Vitrobot. And, we use 3 microliters of sample, but only 2 nanoliters is left on the grid. So most of it is thrown away. The usable area is somewhere between 0 sometimes and 10% of the grid. Often most of it is not really great. We spend hours screening to try and find the very perfect bits of ice on this large, large piece of real estate. And we had a facilities managers meeting here a few months ago, and every facility manager said it takes 5 to 6 hours of screening before people start collecting. Now, that seems horrifying at the price of the microscopes, and that some people only get 24 hours on them. And then the ice thickness can vary quite wildly across the length of the grid. So for the Spotted On project, what we want is some perfect strip of ice, or as perfect as we can get it. We might need 3 microliters to start with, but we can make 1,000 grids with that 3 microliters. We make grid after grid after grid, maybe under different conditions. The usable area should be roughly 100%. We don't want any that isn't. And that means the typical screening time is cut down to just a few minutes. You go find that strip of ice, you might as well start collecting because it's all you've got. If it's no good, you might as well throw the grid out and find another one. If it is good, the whole lot's going to be good so you can get going. And then ice thickness shouldn't vary very much, maybe a factor of 2. So that's what we set out to do. We had new technologies we needed, one of which is just piezoelectric dispensing. That's quite straightforward, inkjet dispensing. And the other is to try and thin it out without blotting. So the piezo dispensing turned out to be fairly easy. We found companies that can dispense 50 picoliter drops. This is a 32 picoliter. People often get muddled up and say, oh, yeah, we've been doing that for years in X industry or Y industry. Most of the time, they're talking nanoliters. We're talking picoliters. A nanoliter is enough to completely flood the grid and is way, way too much sample for us. We have to be on these picoliter positions. So you can spit out a single drop, or you can spit out a whole bunch of drops in a row and accumulate as much fluid as you like on the grid. So that worked out fine. This is what the robot looks like. This is the sort of business end. It's the piezo dispensing system. And we'll quickly show a movie. So what it does, it goes and slurps up a bit of sample. I think now we can go down as low as 2 or 3 microliters is all you need to, because you'd have to have something to slurp up. But obviously, that could get much lower. And then you take it across in front of a camera and inspect the drop to see that it's firing correctly and make adjustments if it's not. And then once you do that, you bring the piezo device into this position. The grid flies past and spot as it goes by. And here's a video I'm just looping through, but you can see the line of spots go down on the grid as it's going flying past into the liquid ethane. Okay, so that was the piezo thing, and that turned out to be really easy. Did that 5 years ago, very happy with ourselves. but we could never get the sample to spread out. I have enormous respect for surface tension of water at this stage, because we tried many, many, many things to get it to spread out without blotting paper. And then about a year or two, maybe a year and a half ago, we discovered a method for growing nanowires on copper grids. Ivan Razenkov, who was an engineer in the lab at the time, discovered this method. It's very, very simple. If this is your copper grid and you put it on a solution, a simple chemical solution, nothing terribly fancy, it grows this perfect, beautiful, bowling green lawn of wires all over the copper. And so we use sandwich grids. This, by the way, is a grid that was exposed for a short time to that solution, and here's for a long time, so you can grow a whole lawn if you expose it for about 3 minutes, and this was less than that. And we have to use sandwich grids, so one side is copper and the other is palladium or gold or rhodium, because we need a smooth surface to pick up our substrate. We don't want this prickly surface because it'll wrinkle the substrate. So we do that. We have these nanowires all over the copper, and on the other side is the nice palladium or rhodium or gold, and that picks up a film, as Chris would have us call it, I think. That's the film. And so what we think is going on then, as we spit this drop towards that grid, here's a video of that being recorded, and here's, say, a still frame of the first drop hitting, and then it spreads out, because it's going to spread out under the velocity and because it's a hydrophilic surface. But then in the second, it hits those nanowires, this massive capillary action just pulls the water right away and leaves a thin film. So I wanted to show, Bob was mentioning putting this in the cryo-scanning electron microscope. We did that, and here's this exact thing that you saw the movie of. This is what the ATLAS looked like in the TEM. And then if you put it in the cryo-scanning electron microscope, you can see here are dry squares, and these two squares were wet. You can see there's ice over them. If we zoom in a little bit more, it's dry over here, and the ice is covering the grid there. But all the water is sucked up along the wires, because this capillary action is just pulling it along the wires. You can see this big sort of glacier's worth of water sitting in the wires, and even if you go, seven grid squares away, all the way to the edge of the grid, that water is being soaked into the wires and can soak up, if I remember rightly, about 10 nanoliters of water that way. Okay, so now we can make these nanowire grids, and Hui in our group can make all kinds of them, and he makes them in batches of about 100 every few weeks. We can make them with lacy carbon film. We can make them with patterned carbon films, thanks to John Rubison's generosity in giving us one of his stamps. And then we can also turn those films into gold, either patterned gold or lacy gold films. And we make all sorts of those. And Chris showed these images of what happens if you have a carbon film and you put it in the electron microscope at a tilt. You can see the carbons moving like crazy. The gold on gold for these nanowire grids doesn't move at all, but happily, neither does the gold substrate on either rhodium or palladium. So we don't have to actually we can use our rhodium copper grids or palladium copper grids, put a gold substrate on, and they act as good as if it was solid gold, I assume, because all these metals more or less act the same way. So this is our Spotted On team. They've worked very, very hard over the last few years to make this work, and some of you can go and get a demo of it. So here's a typical Spotted On experiment. You put the sample down. This is what it looks like in the microscope. It's quite hard to find that strip of ice. It's very, very thin, so you have to go looking for it. You can almost never see it because it is so thin. But then you can collect lots and lots of very nice images, and the holes are more or less the same. They're all more or less the same ice thickness, so you don't have to go hunting around all over the grid. And then you can use that to, very efficiently collect data. So I think this one is one of our records. I think this was only 3 hours, a few hundred images, and then, a map, within the same day to sub-3 angstrom. So the trick here is to get the really beautiful thin ice, know where it is, and start collecting, not wait, so within 3 hours of microscope time, we've got enough data for our 3 angstrom map, as opposed to spending 6 hours trying to find where to collect the data, and maybe it's not the best data. So an example of this being used in the lab, I think it's fair to say that every postdoc and grad student in the lab now chooses to use Spotted On rather than the Vitrobot, even though, it's a work in progress and a prototype. And here's an example of why. This is Priyamvada Acharya. She's an embedded postdoc from Peter Kwong's group at the Vaccine Research Center at NIH. And they want to solve structures at various stages along the HIV trimer and opening up pathway, and they want to solve those with many, many, many different antibodies attached. So pre-invite is routinely getting half a dozen antibodies sent, and they want a structure back. They want a map back of where that antibody sits on her structures. So here's one example where in, I think, a single day, she collected data for three different structures and solved those structures and then got that information back to the VRC, which they need very quickly. And by the way, that was all done at 40 degrees tilt on gold grids because of this work that Dimitri and Yongzi Tan did. So she can do this so efficiently because 20 minutes after she's acquired that grid atlas, she has the first high magnification image acquired from a queue of 50 targets that she set up. So she can go to this grid, find that strip, queue up the targets, and done, and moving on to the next one. So in this particular grid, 28 squares were covered in nice vitreous ice, and 25 of those were suitable for data collection. So there's only a few for some reason or another. And then, of course, if once you see that you have good data, you can keep collecting longer and go to 3.5 angstrom resolution on these things. Here's a whole bunch of other samples that we've used the nanowire grids for. Here's an integral membrane. People often ask, well, will it work with detergents? Will it work with nanodiscs? Yes, it does. It works more or less the same with everything. Here's a different sample, a different sample. We can spot filaments. They don't seem to undergo too much trouble. And various other samples as well. And Alex will talk about some of these. So I think I'm doing okay for time. So we set out to do this because we wanted it to be efficient and not waste protein. We didn't expect it to have any advantages over other than that, over a VitreBot, in terms of these issues with the air-water interface. However, it does, and we think we're starting to understand why. Luke Chow from Steve Harrison's lab wanted to come and use it because they had this terrible aggregation problem. And I was convinced it wouldn't change anything because in the end we're still spreading to a thin film. But in fact, it does. It worked much better on Spotted On. We had much less aggregation. And I think it's this idea that we're outrunning the air-water interface. We're going fast enough that it doesn't have its 1,000 opportunities to hit the air-water interface and stick. It's sticking a little bit less. And the same was true for that data I showed you earlier from Ava's lab. They had to put a layer of carbon down to get any particles over the holes. But, yes?
So you use very small droplets.
Yeah, 50 picoliters.
Doesn't it have a lot of opportunity to hit the air-water interface at that stage?
No, that volume is still enormous when you think about it. It hasn't spread to a thin layer yet, and it's still mostly volume and not so much surface. That volume can spread across, acres of grid, really. So it's more volume than you might imagine, but that's a really good question. So in the case of Ava, they were putting this carbon down. They couldn't get the particles over the holes at all. But with Spotted On, we do see the particles over the holes. And again, I think it's just it doesn't have so much time to pull all those nice particles out onto the carbon and get rid of them. We're doing a little better than that. Yet, still though, as Bob and various others have mentioned, this is probably not what happens to your particles. That's what happens to your particles. They're completely gone. And that happens a lot of the time. So we're really trying to escape that air-water interface is what we're trying to do. And Bob mentioned two different ways of doing it. One is to outrun it. In other words, get that sample spread to a thin layer and into the ethane before it has these multiple opportunities. And this is brand new data, so you can't quote me because who knows if it'll pan out. But we've just got a few, three or four different examples where we show that if we speed up our plunge time to 100 milliseconds between that spot hitting the grid and the grid being into the ethane, if it's 100 milliseconds, our sample is much less preferred. So this is hemagglutinin, HA, and Dimitri and Yongzi used this in their tilt paper because it's pathologically preferred. The thing is just absolutely face up in the ice, stuck to the air-water interface. I think Alex might have some tomograms of this. And you only see that one view. You can't see the view so well, but because they're much fainter when they're on the side. But there's lots and lots of side views tucked in here amongst the face-up view. So it does seem that if we can get it to under 100 milliseconds, we can get it into the ethane before we have this chance for this massive preferred orientation. And we have examples of that now on two other samples as well where it seems to be escaping the preferred orientation. And I think Alex will have a little bit more to say. Oh, Alex, here we go. Alex, who does tomograms on everything, every single thing that goes into the scope, Alex grabs a tomogram on, and so he can study where these particles are relative to the air-water interface, and you'll see many more examples of that. Usually the first question I get when I give this talk is, where can we buy one? And it's not a very well-kept secret at this stage that TTP LabTech is now commercializing the device, and they will be talking at one of the breakout sessions. They'll be, you know, they're starting to make the devices. They also want to hear from the community, what do you want to see in such a device, and what would be important, what wouldn't be. So by all means, go to that breakout session and chat to them or ask them for a quote. Okay, I think, there, you see, 20 minutes. I can get through a 45-minute talk in 20 minutes anytime. So for us, the challenges are not, you know, we don't feel like we're done yet. I mean, we're trying to automate and streamline these three aspects of cryo-electron microscopy. And, you know, that means getting better at the specimen prep for sure, the data collection, the processing and refinement. We'd really like, instead of that to be one day, that should be 1 hour. It would be great if within an hour of getting a grid in a microscope, you could have enough data for a 3D map. And I have no hesitation in saying that should be possible. That's not physics, that's engineering. Our stages need to be better. Our cameras are fast. We should be able to move fast enough and gather data fast enough that we can be getting a couple of hundred images in an hour. And then with things like the phase plate, if it becomes really stable, I think we can maybe live with less particles and then, you know, other advantages like that. So I think there's a lot of engineering that can happen so that we should be able to do 10 samples a day. And then we're starting to maybe, you know, be in the realm of drug discovery. I mean, right now everybody's saying, oh, you know, EM is going to replace X-ray crystallography. Those X-ray crystallographers solve 1,000 structures a day at those synchrotrons, okay? We do one maybe in 5 days on a lucky day. So we've got to get that rate up there to be interesting, I think, in that realm where people want to look at dozens of ligands or hundreds of ligands. We need to speed up. Okay. Oh, so, you know, why do we want to do this? Because we have so many users. We also might want to look at these million particle data sets. Sometimes there's 1% of your data that is really what you need to look at. So you need a million particles, but you're only ending up with, you know, a few tens of thousands that are contributing to your map. So again, you need to be really efficient, because very hard to give up a microscope for 5 days to somebody who says, you know, I've got to have my map, but I need a million particles. So that's the group. Gold is surrounding the Spotted-On team. As I say, they've worked incredibly hard. Go visit with them to get a demo. Oh, by the way, the demos were completely oversubscribed, so we're going to have two more sessions. So the people in the second blocks will fit you in during the manufacturer's exhibit and also the second poster session. And so come talk to me about that. So this is the team. This is Simon's Electron Microscopy Center. We have an amazing group of technical expertise led by Bill and Ed, and with everybody else helping out. And they keep all those microscopes perfectly tuned, perfectly aligned, and perfectly ready to go every day. Then we have a technical team who do Spotted-On and Legend-On and Appion. And these guys are postdocs, but very much part of that technical team. And then we have the grad students and postdocs who are really the engine that drive this whole thing. They have biological projects they want solved. They need the technology. And there's this very close synergy between the biology driving the technology and then the technology trying new things, which allows them to do new biology. Great. Thanks for your attention. I'm done.
Questions?
Hi, Bridget. So the commercial version, at least the initial one, I guess you have a single nozzle for the sample deposition, or there will be also option for the multiple nozzles?
Go and talk to them and say that's what you want. I don't know. We are not building it. They are building it. Mm-hmm. And we have no idea what they're building. Is Melanie...
In the lab, the one you had, at least what I saw last year, you had a single nozzle. Have you also tried
them? No, we have space for four on ours.
Have you tried them?
We used to do that often in the past, and we're planning to do that again. We just haven't had a chance. The problem with Spotted-On, in some sense, in our lab, is it's been too successful. Now everybody wants to use it all day long. and we can't do experiments with it anymore. But we're getting a second prototype from TTP LabTech, I hope in January, and then this one we can tear apart and start doing cool things with again.
Mm-hmm.
So we've, you know, it's become a production machine. I mean, yesterday, I think Venkat told me they made 22 grids, you know, for three different people. I mean, they're just using it all the time.
For condition screening, like optimizing a sample or something, these four nozzles could be quite useful,
exactly.
I guess.
Exactly, that's what we want to do, yeah. You know, you can strip down four different concentrations or, you know, or four different other things and then just dump it in and have a quick look which one works. Well, and if any one of them works, there's enough data in that strip to collect an entire data set, yeah. So that would be the goal, but, you know, every time we mess with it, we break it, and then people are quite upset that they can't use it. Like Yongzi, who only makes 3 microliters of sample because he can't use a Vitrobot. Sorry, Jan. I think you just heard a vote for 4 nozzles.
I'm a little confused about your answer on the 4-barrel spotted on. Earlier, I think you said the individual drops can spread over quite a large footprint on the grid.
Yeah, but...
And so what is the interference between, you know, 4 different channels?
Yeah, we don't know, again, because we haven't done it, but... The water always seems to run along the wires, and you always see dry squares next to, you know, the square you hit is wet.
But if you had 4 barrels, you would be limiting how thin, especially the ones in the center.
But I think Hui and Venkat can show you, it doesn't spread that far from the wires. You know, with those 50 picoliter drops, it's only a couple of grid squares over that seem to be wetting. The one I showed you where it was wet all the way to the end of the square, we overloaded that grid with, I don't know, you know, 20 nanoliters of sample.
I see.
Not 50 picoliters is what we're using now. So it doesn't seem to go so far. But this is all totally unknown. We need to put the 4 nozzles on. We need to do the experiments. We haven't had a chance, but we will, I hope, come January. Did you hear that, Bob? I wish you'd use the microphone, Russell, so everyone can hear you. But basically, they're saying they're making the grids too, and they can put moats between these strips and sort of manufacture things. You know, so they manufacture it from the ground up, and which I've always thought should be possible, you know, rather than these little flimsy things we have. Is that paraphrasing you well enough? Was there another question?
Bridget, how fast do you have to be to completely outrun the air interactions with the air-water interface?
Well, you know, that we could talk about that a bit more at the panel. I mean, 1,000 times a second, you know, in 100 milliseconds, still got 100 opportunities. But presumably, they don't always stick at the air-water interface. Although you saw with this hemagglutinin, some of them are still in that quite preferred orientation. I don't know if that's natural or they still are somewhat preferred. And this is, you know, data from 2 days ago, so... We don't yet know. But we have a real sample, insulin receptor, which also is unpreferred under these conditions. And then Alex will show you a third example. You know, my guess is it hits and hits, and some of the times it sticks and some of the times it doesn't. So if you give it 1,000 opportunity, it's done. If you maybe only have 100 opportunities, maybe you get some of them still in solution.
Hi, Bridget.
Sorry.
Just very quickly, it occurs to me that if you had even 2 nozzles pointed at the same position, that you had control over the phase of the timing, that you could do time resolved almost immediately.
Yes,
have you tried that?
Absolutely what we want to do next. Again, dying to get back to experiments and stop making grids. But that's scheduled for next year, and you'll hear from Jack later on, I think. We're hoping to work, you know, with some of the things they're doing in, you know, mixing with their little devices. But the other option is just to have the 2 grids hit in midair. And from the research I've seen, droplets that size mix very rapidly and very well. So you should get a lot of really excellent mixing, but again, we just have to try that out and see. It's not that easy also to have pinpoint accuracy, so we have to do a little bit more work on that.